Talk given Friday, 4th of May, 1973. I want first to quote from the Mahavagga, which is one of the books of the discipline in Theravada Buddhism. It's part of the Vinaya Pitaka. It is said that after the Enlightenment, the Buddha spends 7 days at the goatherd's banyan tree and spends all those days in meditation unceasingly. At the end of the 7 days, he says these words: "The Brahman whose nature is unsinful, not harsh, unstained, and restrained, who has traversed knowledge and fully traversed the Brahma path, that is, lived the holy life, he rightly, a Brahman, ought to announce the Brahma word. He who has no self-obtrusiveness in the world." Now I want you to take special notice of this part of that statement. The Brahman who has mastered knowledge and fully traversed the Brahma path. And the word used in the text is Vedagu. Vedagu, who has gone to the end of the Vedas, because it was the Vedic knowledge, which of course included the Upanishads and the Aranyakas, which was the religious heritage of Brahmanical India. It's very important to notice these little things. Now, of course, this Vedic knowledge covered a tremendous field. And we get some conception of what this field was in the Chandogya Upanishad, in that very famous discourse between Narada, the disciple, and Sanat Kumara, his teacher. I have often quoted the opening words, but we'll go a little bit more into detail with his list of subjects. I'm just using the word for convenience. Subjects. His list of subjects of which he was already master when he went to Sanat Kumara. You know how he approaches Sanat Kumara and says, "Teach me, venerable sir." And Sanat Kumara says, "Tell me what you already know, and then I will tell you more." And then Narada gives his list. And his list runs as follows. I will first read just the usual English translation, which is partly correct only, but very shaky in the rest of it. He knows all the four Vedas: the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda. He knows the epic and ancient lore. He knows the Veda of the Vedas, and within brackets, as an explanation, grammar. He knows all about the propitiation of the ancestors, the fathers. the science of numbers, and within brackets is written mathematics. The science of portents, the science of time, and within brackets is written chronology. Logic, ethics and politics, the science of the gods, the science of sacred knowledge, the science of elemental spirits, the science of weapons, astronomy, the science of serpents and the fine arts. This, venerable sir, I know. Now, I want to take the original Sanskrit words and deal with them. What is translated as the propitiation of the fathers? The word used is Pitriam. Pitris. The Pitris are the fathers. And these are supposed to be rites, R-I-T-E-S, in honor of the ancestors and the progenitors. The word Rasim is called the science of numbers. Within brackets, mathematics, as in this translation, and in all the usual English translation. Now, with regard to this science of numbers, let us forget mathematics. In the ordinary sense of the term, arithmetic and whatnot. Numbers were used in the esoteric teachings of the original Veda, as well as for the Kabbalah, to represent profound metaphysical concepts. And these numbers were associated with letters of the alphabet. Now, the letters of the alphabet, in the case of the Kabbalah, which as far as I'm aware is more developed than with the Veda in this respect, the letters of the alphabet are themselves proper names, composed, therefore, of other alphabetical letters when you pronounce them. You see, take the first four letters of the Kabbalah. Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet. Now you see, they are words in themselves which, if written out, are composed of alphabetical letters. Now, if each letter has its own metaphysical significance as such, and is attached to certain numbers which are associated with cosmic energies, then any sentence in Hebrew, any single word in Hebrew, means not only what it means colloquially, but also involves all the meanings involved in the metaphysical concepts attached to each single letter. If you take the first letter, first word of Genesis, Bereshit, see, you've got the Beit, you've got the Resh, you've got the Yod, you've got the Shein, you've got the Tav. You see? All right. All those letters, themselves being proper names, are composed of other letters. And the way they are arranged brings into being a tremendous system of exposition as regards the play of cosmic energies and the way they affect our lives. And they are insights into our being and our growth, our fulfillment. You see? This is a tremendous thing. And since they are letters and words which correspond to cosmic energies and the play of cosmic energies, which means the whole creative process, and since we associate creation, creative power, with the word God as such, the scripture is quite legitimately called the Word of God. It's an extraordinary thing, and it's a very profound thing altogether. Now, this was the science of numbers that they referred to. Not multiplying 2 by 2 or dividing 10 by 1. Some people still make 13 out of it. Science of numbers. And this is the real Rasim. Now we go on to the next one, Devam, which is translated as the science of portents, of augury. Actually, this was the science of the nature and function of the devas. The word devas is usually translated as gods, and if one wants to translate the word very loosely and bring down the ire of scholars on one's head, quite justifiably in this case, one says angels. Devas do not correspond to the concept angels as in Christian teaching, for instance, or Islamic teaching, you see. But now, who are these devas? What are these devas? We have gone into this before too, so I won't spend too much time over it. The devas are the personifications of man's own awareness, his knowledge of the way in which the transcendent energies of the mind and the spirit on their own plane function. These are the devas. You can work out the meanings of the names of archangels and angels, and you will find extraordinary depths in them. So this was the science of the devas, actually. Devam. And because these energies lie at the back of, they are the great inner controlling powers of universal process and the emergence of the pattern of our lives, especially psychologically and spiritually, they were regarded as the portents, the omens. Now, the pattern of function of these energies on their own at their own transcendent level has correspondences with the pattern which is immediately present around one now. And people tried, those who had sensitivity along these lines, they tried to correlate the pattern of things around them. the flight of birds or the shape of the clouds or whatever it may have been, you see, to correlate them with these transcendent, the transcendent aspect of these patterns. And this was something of the inner science of portents. But you'll see at once that these things could have reality and truth in accuracy in them only if he who tries to read the portents was himself the perfected Holy One. Otherwise, the ordinary man who may have some sensitivities along these lines, trying to read these portents, would impose all his own conditioning, his illusions and delusions upon what he is trying to read and give you a garbled version. You see what is involved in this kind of thing. There are aspects of our mental lives which have now become a closed book to us. In those days, speculative philosophy, the exercise of the intellect in terms of the building up of logical systems of philosophy, and of course modern science and technology and so forth just didn't exist. Therefore, man's mind, his energies, his psycho-spiritual energies became preoccupied with that with which he was in contact then and there. And he lived very much more in tune with nature and nature's ways then than we do now. Now we try to live in terms of dominating nature. We are all out for the conquest of nature, the conquest of space, the conquest of this, that and the other. Instead of realizing that I, the ordinary mortal, will inevitably die. I have only a short 60, 70, 80 years, whatever it may be. And to strut about the world stage, dominating nature, is the hallmark of my stupidity. But those people saw things differently. Earth, nature, was Mother Earth, Mother Nature to them. They understood this tremendous principle of positive-negative, male-female, in interaction throughout the universal process. And therefore, they developed all this. But it has become a lost art. But this, as far as I can make out, is really what it all refers to. Now we'll take the next one. The term vako vakyam is usually translated as logic. As it stands, we might translate it as the word of the word. The word of the word. So I've condensed it into the simple phrase, the original Veda, which was an unwritten thing. The original Veda, which contained, which was written in a form which had to be interpreted in terms of the science of numbers and letters and all the rest of it. I mean, you know, for instance, those of you who are interested in yoga today, if you read the textbooks in depth, and if you read modern works like Lama Govinda's Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism, and various other works like that, you will find how, with the various chakras, the letters of the Sanskrit alphabet are associated. And it is said quite openly that these are the words of power, the sounds of power, They are mantras. They have an effect as such. You see? Pronounce them, intone them in the right way, which is a secret handed down from teacher to disciple. Intone them in the right way, and you can rouse up the play of electrochemical energies, psychical energies within the living body. Now it is important to understand all this very clearly. You see, it's a little bit like this. This point about intoning it in the right way. I'll give you a simile which may help. Supposing a bright young fellow gives you a brilliant performance on the piano of a Chopin study or Beethoven sonata or whatever it is. Yes, it's very fine. But you listen to the great masters playing the same thing, and the effect is entirely different, isn't it? When they play it, something goes into the depths of your being as the playing of a brilliant amateur doesn't do. So, intoning in the right way, the mantra as such, has that sort of effect. And this underlies all ritual, either performed by one individual or congregationally. Where are the congregations today that can sing and participate completely and wholly in a ceremony in that manner? It's almost impossible to find them. I've been told by one person, certainly, who is a university lecturer. He's an Indian in this country, who has experienced the Vedic ritual in its real perfection. And he says that the effect, he told me, that the effect upon his whole being was so powerful, so transformative, that from that time, from that day, he was a different man. You see? These things have to be taken into account. So, Vako Vakyam, the original Veda. Now, another word is used by Narada, Ekayanam. And the translation really is, the one and only way to do things. Obviously, the one and only way to do things necessarily implies the perfect way. Nothing but perfection is good enough. And this is the word which is translated as politics and ethics. Now, of course, in the field of politics and ethics, one could do everything in the one and only way, which is the perfect way, the right way, from the standpoint of the truth, the reality, the spirit. Then it is really the one and only way. But can anyone say that anywhere in the world modern politics has the least resemblance to that? Now, the next word he uses is Deva Vidyam, the knowledge of the gods. Remember, we already had the word Daivam. That is the practical aspect of the activity of the devas. Now, Deva Vidyam, the knowledge of the gods. And I have worked it out this way. That means really the manner in which the archetypal energies are personified. Let's, if we take the Rig Vedic names, which we have already dealt with, Varuna, Indra, Soma, Agni, yes, Brihaspati, Pushan, various others like that. You see, you take their counterparts in Greek teaching, Uranus. He's the counterpart of Varuna. Zeus is the counterpart of Indra. Apollo, Athene, and so forth. You take the archangelic and angelic names, Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, Michael, really. And we call it Michael, of course. Uriel, Samuel, and so forth. You see? All these names stand for archetypal energies. You may ask, what are these archetypal, what do you mean by archetypal energies? The energies of mind at its own transcendent level. The Holy One in meditation, in samadhi, in the full samadhi, is perfectly in touch, in communion with the play of these energies, which cannot be translated by the intellect in the terms of knowledge with which we are acquainted in our everyday world of affairs and life. Because the terms of knowledge of our everyday life are confined entirely to things, events, thoughts, feelings, which have the senses and the discursive mind as their avenues for obtaining their impressions and for interpreting those impressions. So this is the mortal realm, the finite realm only. Whereas that is that non-finite state, the infinite state, which every one of us disappears into at death, but which for him who has grown to his fullness as man can experience and realize here now whilst alive. So this was the Deva Vidya. Now, similarly, Brahma Vidya, this is the knowledge of Brahman, the ultimate real. We use the word knowledge, which is a hopelessly bad word. The Sanskrit uses the word Vidya. But what other word can we use if we talk about it? It's about the only word we can use. Brahma Vidya, he has the knowledge of Brahman. In the profoundest states of meditation, in the ultimate communion, one is completely at one with the ultimate real. There is no distinction, no separation whatsoever. It is because in Christian mysticism, men like Eckhart knew this, that they made bold to say, "For man verily is God, God verily is man." Note the importance of stating the same fact both ways, starting with man verily is God and God verily is man. So, yes. Then, after one returns to the ordinary state of consciousness, one remains completely quiet for a very long time. One doesn't say, "Oh, now my wonderful meditation in which I was at one with God is over. Let's go to the cinema," or whatever it is. Nothing like that. For days and days, they are perfectly quiet. And in that quiet, still state, where there is no disturbance of emotion, of thought, of, and certainly of desire or anything like that, no evil-mindedness is at all present, the brain will gradually release a form of thought and its appropriate expression in speech, which can inspire the sensitive one, one who is ready to take the next step forward. This is the meaning of the word prophecy in the full sense. The prophetic utterances, the prophetic writings of the great ones, the holy ones. This is the way to understand these things. Then he has, Narada says, he has the bhuta vidya, the knowledge of the demonic forces. That is to say, the catabolic forces, the forces which break down, their business is to break down. The anabolic forces bring the thing into manifestation. When the purpose of that entry into manifestation is fulfilled, that manifestation must let go and be willing to meet its own death. This is what man can do consciously. And insofar as man can do this consciously, he is completely in harmony with the activity of the divine all the time, all his life. But this is what we can't do. The feminine side of us, the preservative side of us, the negative side as we call it, having brought the form into being and finding it pleasant and agreeable and giving a sense of security, we want to preserve that. But the creative life energy won't have it. If I oppose that creative life energy, it's the creative life energy which disrupts that which I'm holding on to and breaks it up. Then I suffer a lot. And I complain, now what did I do to deserve this? Well, I was stupid enough to want to perpetuate what was excellent in such a place and such a time. Of course it was excellent, of course it was perfect, wonderful, beautiful. But the place and time have changed from moment to moment. And therefore I must let it go, I mustn't grasp it. You see, this is wisdom. Real wisdom. And you see how, what a Herculean task it is, what a Himalayan task, to be able to live like that, to live up to it. So now, the knowledge of the demonic forces is the knowledge of the catabolic process. Now if you have that, and if you're sensitive to it, you work with the anabolic forces as they are building up, and you work with the catabolic forces as they are breaking down. That is to say, you don't take a hammer and bust anything up. You don't grasp at the thing which has been brought into being. You let it go. And in the letting go, from within your own being, there emerge all the elements which are recreating something new. This is the way, it is in this way that we can understand that word progress, spiritual progress, in a deep and a profound sense. Otherwise we think of it in the childish sense of climbing the rungs of a ladder and, getting first class honors and all that sort of thing. Nothing like that. Nothing to do with it. You see why I have throughout the years warned, leave religion alone unless you are prepared to see and abide by the very deep things. There is nothing for me. The isolated, separate, living, existent. It has come into being, it has to fulfill not my purpose, but the purpose of the totality as it works through this manifestation which the totality has brought forth. Read the book of Job there. It's very, very instructive. When God says to Job, "Canst thou do this, that, and the other?" It is this totality, this transcendent energy, this universal thing, which does everything. And I have the stupidity and the conceit, the ignorance, the pathetic ignorance, hence deserving of the utmost compassion, that I do this, that, and the other, that I bend things to my will. I'm a nice devil. Now, the next thing is the kshatra vidya. Now, you know, the kshatriyas were the warrior caste, the members of the warrior caste, as it is called. And the word warrior did not merely refer to the armed forces, but the kshatriya was the administrator, the ruler. The king was a kshatriya, you see, the judge, everybody of that nature belongs to the kshatriya caste. And every kshatriya wielded power. Power was placed in his hands. Isn't that so? All right. So now, the knowledge or science possessed by the kshatriya caste, it was the science of power. It has been translated usually as politics at the worldly level. Now, actually, this power is the manipulation, in the religious context, is the manipulation of psychomental forces or cosmic energies. You might say, how on earth do I, an ordinary mortal, manipulate cosmic energies? Well, consider it this way. In the physical world, in modern times, what sort of energies do we manipulate? Absolutely colossal powers, don't we? The simple forms are electrical, heat energy, light energy, this, that, and the other, chemical energy, and so forth. But on the titanic scale, atomic energies we manipulate. Now, similarly, with the world of the mind, the true Holy One, the true yogi, is the one who manipulates these forces. When one actually practices yoga in its fullness, all that is within our own psychophysical organism is dealt with in such a manner as to become the receiving set for the inflow of these titanic cosmic energies. See, hence always this warning, beware, don't meddle with the thing, leave it alone. The absolute basis is the purity of mind and heart, the living of the pure life, and no nonsense about it. So the kshatra vidya was of that nature. It's translated as politics. At the worldly level, you could use it that way also. But I mean, why need Narada go to Sanat Kumara to realize communion with the ultimate real and then talk about politics as part of his knowledge? It's of no use to him at that level, isn't it? So it is, this is the real meaning of the Kshatravidya, the manipulation of power at that level. Then there is the Nakshatravidya. Nakshatra. Now, nakshatra means an asterism. It means positions of the planets and the passage of the moon through the various constellations and all that sort of thing. In short, it refers to astrology. Nakshatra Vidya. The knowledge of the stars. And it was in both aspects that they obtained, that they studied their stars as ordinary astronomy and also as astrology. A useful way of regarding astrology sensibly is to consider it as the psychological, or if you like to go even deeper, which is better, the psycho-spiritual counterpart of the patterns of the stars as we see them in terms of ordinary physical astronomy. You see? Nothing is purely physical. Nothing is purely spiritual. Exclusively so, I mean. What we call physical also includes everything else. What we call psychological or intellectual or spiritual, that word also includes everything else. It is only because that if we tried to communicate at that level, we couldn't communicate with words. Words have to be specific. They have to be limited in their context, their meaning. Hence different words, physical, psychological, spiritual, and so forth. But in actuality, there is only this one total reality. And if you have the sense of the one total reality, all the finite elements will fit in beautifully in your own mind and in your own being, and making your own life a harmony, because they will be always rightly related as separate bits to the totality and with each other within themselves. And this is the really deep aspect of religious study, because it is an approach to the whole reality through your senses, through your discursive mind activity, through your speech faculty, and through your communion in the profoundest awareness with the totality. See, religion and the religious life is something so tremendous, we have not the slightest concept, not the slightest inkling of what it is like. So now, astrology is the understanding of the psycho-spiritual counterpart. Now, you may wonder, what do I mean by a spiritual counterpart, and why do I have the psychical or mental different from the spiritual? What I mean is this. As far as I've been able to see for myself, I take responsibility for this statement. I haven't come across it in any of the works which exist, Western or Eastern, on astrology. The configurations of the stars are indicative of your own states of awareness, your modes of awareness, your innermost depths of consciousness. That is what they represent. Now, consciousness in itself, you can dissociate from thought and feeling and your psychical life and your physical life and so forth. But this is the root source of the most powerful functioning of cosmic energy through you. This phrase, standing on the mount of the Lord, ascending the mount of the Lord, this phrase is associated with what I have just been trying to tell you. When you stand on the mount of the Lord, it is not you who stand there, but your mode of awareness is completely at one with transcendent reality, with the totality. And it is from here that the pattern of your life opens up from day to day. Now, the next term is Sarpavidya. Now, Sarpa means a serpent. The serpent symbolism is a tremendous symbolism. We won't try to go into that tonight. There's not enough time for all that. And the next word he uses is Devajana, which is the knowledge of serpents. Now, this has nothing to do with just the ordinary scientific knowledge of the species. The knowledge of serpents. I'll just mention one hint here. Jesus' words, "Be ye wise as serpents." Surely the dear little wiggly wigglies who crawl about on the surface of the earth is not what he was referring to. So now, you see, the study of the scriptures and the study of that study which one has to master in order to reach the end of the Veda, as the Buddha said, is something very, very tremendous. It is a study which involves the whole process of our daily living. We learn by the actual living process with the totality of our being. That is what it means. And that is the religious life in the great sense of the term, in the true sense of the term. That is one way of regarding it and understanding it. There are so many ways.